that responsibility, as Ani said, across the entire listening audience and make your call right now. 877-500-5266.
Thank you, Sam and Ani. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned. Coming up, it's Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland. His guest is Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, The 60s Counterculture in the 70s.
KBOO would like to thank the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers today. Kenny and Zooks for providing breakfast. They have three locations in Portland serving pastrami, bagels, sandwiches, and other deli items. Located at 1038 Southwest Stark, 3901 North Williams, and 2376 Northwest Thurman. Apriza Mexican Cuisine for providing lunch. Serving Mexican cuisine for takeout and drive-through in a recycled shipping container located at 2311 Southeast 8th Avenue. Archena for providing dinner, located at 7742 Southeast 13th, serving Italian cuisine using ingredients from local Portland area farmers.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee Wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Full Circle Resale, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories with a focus on natural fibers since 1984. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Wednesday Talk Radio, first day of our membership drive. My name is Paul Roland. I'll be with you for the next hour. And we've got a special membership drive guest this morning, Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, The 60s Counterculture in the 70s. And I guess Ron just missed that event, Woodstock, and where that song comes from, of course. We're all volunteers of America. We're certainly volunteers here on KBOO Community Radio. I am anyway, and most of us who put on programming for you are, and we appreciate your support to allow us to continue to do what we do. So, Ron, are you with us?
I am.
Good morning. We're getting you in Vermont, right?
Yes, that's correct. Yes, it's a hot, sunny day here in Vermont. It's 11 o'clock in the morning.
Well, good morning to you, and welcome to KBOO's airwaves. Have you ever been on KBOO before?
I never have. I used to listen when I lived out in that area, but I've never been on it before. Nope.
Yeah, you were saying that. You lived up in Olympia for a while. Well, we'll talk about that and lots of other things, but we're mainly going to be talking about your new book, Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s. And, of course, you've written a number of other books, including The Way the Wind Blew, A History of the Weather Underground, Short Order Frame Up, The Co-Conspirator's Tale, and All the Sinners, Saints. And you write a lot for Counterpunch, where I first encountered you and still regularly encounter you. You write a lot on music, and that's a lot of what your book is about, in addition to your experiences kind of catching the tail end of the 60s and then into the 70s. So tell us, what is this book all about? What does it mean, the 60s counterculture in the 70s?
Okay, I mean, the framework of the book is, I see the 70s as the decade, or the, you know, if you can freeze something in time, the decade when the spirit of the 60s, the peace, love, and brother, whatever you want to call it, brotherhood, it transitioned as it got into the Reagan era and the greed and everything that went along with Ronald Reagan and everything that's followed since then, the whole rise of neoliberal capitalism, the kind of destruction of a lot of the social systems and the anti-racism giving way once again to forms of racism and so on. And what my book kind of does, it frames it in terms of the counterculture, which was a key part of the 60s. I mean, it was more than peace, love, and hate Ashbury. It was also a lot of things like the Yippies and the White Panther Party and various other, you know, food co-ops, all different kinds of things that, you know, and my book talks about the stuff that stayed, the stuff that went away, and tries to look at it and try to examine through, like as you mentioned, through my experiences, through historical narrative, and through the music and so on, how it changed and why it changed.
So, just out of curiosity, so in terms of like scholarship, people who like have really looked at that period, you know, and the term counterculture, who would you say has really got it right?
That's a good call. You know, I would say, in terms of the scholarly kind of stuff, I think Charles Reich had some of it right in his book, The Greening of America. I think Theodore Roszak, in his book, The Making of a Counterculture, had a really good scholarly approach to it. Other than that, it's kind of, you know, to look for other more, it's a mishmash of different pieces and different writers writing about it. There's probably been a couple of newer ones that came out, but those, to me, are the fundamental books that really kind of pull it all together and try to explain what it was in terms of its spiritual and some of its political meaning.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, there's sort of this, a lot of these tensions, conflicts, contradictions that emerged then and, of course, predated the 60s and still continue, in fact, that we've never really resolved, you know, the sort of the politicos versus the hippies and the freaks, you know, all these things that were, those were both real, and but they kind of evolved also.
Yeah, I would say I guess you could kind of look at the debate nowadays, the political situation. You could look at the new right, and a lot of the cultural and social arguments that have been going on since the 80s, at least, are over things that started in the 60s, abortion, you know, LGBTQ rights and gay marriage and the legalization of marijuana, and all these kind of issues, and even the other side of it, like criminalization of various behaviors and all that kind of stuff. Those have all been used by by the right wing to keep those arguments alive and you know, even the, some of the stuff, and push and push. And fortunately for us, they haven't won everything. I mean, there is gay marriage. You live in a state where marijuana has been legalized. And so it's a constant push and shove. Like you said, they have not been resolved. And a lot of them, you could even look at it as being part of that thing that went on back then, the hippies versus the freaks versus the straights and the right, you know, that LBJ versus the hippies, Richard Nixon versus the new left and versus the counterculture, all that kind of stuff. And probably some of the places where it's played out the most over those years is in the social arena and in the terms of the drug war.
And I'm speaking with Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s. And we are in our membership drive, and we have a number of copies of that available. If you would like to get that for a contribution to our station, a thank you gift for you for contributing and keeping community radio alive. Of course, we were born in 1968, of course, in the tail end of the 60s, the time period that kind of begins, that Ron Jacobs begins this book with a lot of great personal stories. You're really coming of age in that time. You're encountering some of the personalities and the figures of that time. You're talking about the various issues as you've been talking about. I think it's a really great read. I stayed up late a couple nights and I went right through it. I would really recommend this book to really understand, you know, where we're at now as we're talking about. So as I said, we are in our membership drive and would really appreciate your support. The number to call is 877-500-5266. We have some other voices to encourage you as well.
Good morning, Paul. This is Ani. And yes, that is right. That is the number to call, 877-500-5266. Like I was mentioning during Democracy Now!, community radio, KBOO, digs deep to give you context for things that are going on around us. And this is another great example of that. You know, I've been struck lately when I'm looking at the news and social currents in this country and the Black Lives Matters movement in particular, I'm struck by the parallels to the civil rights struggle, to the Student Nonviolent Organizing Committee. This is a very relevant time to check out. It is where a lot of things, a lot of resistance is actually deeply rooted. And I think this kind of history, again, is so important to actually know, to learn, to share. And with your contribution of $60 or more, we would love to thank you by making a copy of this book available, by sending it to you, Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s. This is a wonderful way, again, to get this history and to share it with friends and family. You can, share the book around. It is important information and, again, provides context, which is so important. Otherwise, we become ahistoric and things just sort of randomly happen. And it's a lot harder to organize for a great new world when things just happen. So know our history and actually become a part of this legacy of social change. As you heard, so many movements started in the 60s or got gained a lot of ground in the 60s, gained a lot of momentum. It is time to revive that spirit of resistance and continue the momentum for a better world. And part of that is contributing to your community radio station. It is strengthening your community. It is adding your support to this media resource, which brings you information, opinions, news, interviews, book reviews, performing arts reviews, all manner of things, plus amazing music and inspirational moments together, poetry shows, for heaven's sakes. Come together right now and contribute. Sustain KBOO, your community radio station. $10 a month, $15 a month. What can you afford to budget into your budget for your community? 877-500-5266, that number to call, or online at kboo.fm.
And thank you so much, Ani. And we're back with, I'm Paul, with Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, the 60s counterculture in the 70s. And so Ron, there's in your first chapter, I just wanted, there's a lot of myths, about the 60s now. It seems like this time that's like far away. It's become so heavily filtered through both, you know, right wing, left wing, various other points of view, that people have their own axes to grind. They have their own ideological framework with it, which to view it, and obviously you and I do too as well. But I like to sort of parse through at least one aspect of this, which is the idea that the counterculture that you talk about, that you yourself were so heavily immersed in, sort of emerged out of this abundance of the 60s. It was a very middle class phenomenon. I just want to read quickly a sentence that you wrote in on page 4. By the early 70s, elements of the counterculture could be detected in nearly every U.S. community and in many places overseas. Its class nature had transcended its origins in the nation's middle class and was becoming part of a new working class understanding that propelled the culture out of the universities and into workplaces, bars, shopping centers, and other places young people gathered. Maybe you could expand on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is, it's interesting because at the same time, this was America in the post-World War II time period, those first couple decades, the 50s and the 60s, America was the most prosperous nation on earth. Working class people, for the most part, the men, and still mostly men were working, more women were still at home. It was the Betty Friedan kind of thing. But working class people had, most of them had union jobs, and so they were making really good money, and so they could afford things for their children that their parents could not afford for them coming out of the Depression and the war. And along with that came a different, if you add in television, which was becoming greater and greater, a greater and greater force in terms of media and its outreach and influencing the popular culture. If you add that in, it kind of made it so that these middle class bourgeois, whatever you want to call them, aspirations of that the counterculture, that birthed the counterculture in the first place. Basically people who had plenty of everything, had all the material things they needed, were going to college. These young people were frustrated with what they saw, the dullness of middle-class life, the gray flannel suit, go out, get a job, buy a car, have kids, get your house in the suburbs, la-di-da. They were looking for something more exciting. So in the 50s, they became beatniks, or beats, as you call them, or they become jazz aficionados, or they became poets, they became artists, or they became even rock and rollers. By the late 60s, there are so many working class people whose children were also at this comfort level in terms of the material goods they had. And the fact that the record companies were learning better, at the entertainment business was learning better and better how to sell stuff to teenagers, because they realized that the teenagers had the largest disposable income in the United States. And the rock and roll business, when the Beatles came along, that kicked it into hyperdrive. They really learned well how to package stuff. But it was at an interesting place, because while the Beatles were the first kind of like Justin Bieber, Britney Spears, Rihanna kind of band where they were packaged, they also were true musicians. They also questioned everything they were doing at the time. And they also became hippies themselves, which was reflected back to the greater world. And a lot of people listen and say, I'm just taking the Beatles because they're the best example. It reached into homes throughout that, like I said, transcended class. And so more and more, then you add in other things. People, the war was not helping things, because it was mostly working class men who were getting drafted. That created greater disenchantment once they got out of their homes where the war was still being popular, and were introduced to rock and roll music, counterculture ideas, marijuana, and then if they got sent to Vietnam, you just kind of got pissed off at the reality that was there. So all of this was kind of coming together to move the counterculture to make it actually a very popular, a mass culture.
That's the interesting thing, the interaction between mass culture and, you know, real social changes. And it's some obviously that, you know, the whatever the powers that be or the institutional, you know, economic guiders, leaders sort of learn that lesson very well, obviously. And we can talk about that when we come back after our next membership break. But the way that, you know, figures like the Beatles, you know, there's a certain resistance now to sort of looking at like individuals and their own like consciousness as being sort of motivate, you know, major factors in change. But, you know, when you have a mass culture and you have, you know, force, you know, groups like the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or whatever, who are having this incredible breadth of influence, you know, the fact that, you know, the changes in their own consciousness they undergo becomes reflected in their music. And that in turn, it was really, you know, you could call it in sort of neo-Marxian terms, a dialectical process in some sense.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And that's what I believe occurred, you know, on so many different levels. We still don't know exactly how much or anything, but that's so true. When you think of that, and when you also think of more and more people were getting educated. I mean, college was very inexpensive at the time. Anybody could go to school for like a few hundred dollars a year. It was encouraged because the system at the time needed a lot of college-educated youth because they were creating this whole new level, the managerial class, if you wanted to call them that. But people who were not, you know, so a lot, and that was the dream of a lot of these men who had gone to work in the factories, building cars, being roughnecks, whatever they were. They wanted their kids to not have to work hard, to do physical labor. And so that was the American dream when the American dream was still working. Of course, it worked at the expense of the rest of the world, but that's still the case for those who still can live the American dream.
Well, Ron, let's hold that thought. There's a lot of threads there to pick up when we resume our conversation in a few minutes. But as I said, we are in our membership drive. And Ron, I know you appreciate community radio and understand its importance, not just community radio, but alternative media. You know, you were around when the underground press was still going in the United States and the role that played in the development of an alternative or counterculture. So maybe you would like to give a plug for alternative media here.
Absolutely. I think alternative media and especially alternative radio stations like KBOO FM are extremely crucial at this time, and the support, they need to be supported because they are one of the few remaining non-commercial forms of media existing, especially in the United States. And while the internet has its role and so on, there's still that nothing that is as free form and spontaneous as a good alternative radio station. And when it comes to alternative radio stations, I honestly believe that KBOO FM is one of the best.
All right. And if you want to, if that resonates with you, if you agree with that, give us a call at 877-500-5266.
Thanks, Paul. This is Ani. We're listening to this interview that you are doing currently with Ron Jacobs. It's a great interview. And of course, right now, folks are listening. And this is that time. Step forward and become a member of KBOO Community Radio. Maybe you haven't done so ever. Maybe you're always figuring that other person's picking up the tab. But really, we're counting on you. We are grassroots radio. We are listener supported. And you, dear listener, well, that's your role right now. Not only are you with us with your ears and your mind, but we would love it if you would, in fact, step forward and be a financial supporter of KBOO. 877-500-5266. We're looking to raise $800 this morning for talk radio. And with your support, it is so possible. It is so doable. And it'll keep us going through this morning. It'll buoy our steps. It'll, lift our spirits. And right now, we are looking for you to do exactly that. 877 800-500-5266. Say thank you to Paul and all the other volunteers that come in and create fantastic content to educate, to inspire, to keep us together, to keep us informed of what is going on and where these currents started, how they all weave together into this whole complex tapestry that is the social change movements, and how KBOO is at the hub of oh so many of those movements, because in fact we are the community's radio station, many communities taking part in the station, and keeping us all stronger together. Right now, we're asking for your contribution, your strength added to the mix. 877-500-5266. Remember, with your $60 contribution, you can get a copy of this book, Daydream Sunset, 60s Counterculture in the 70s. You're listening to the interview. You know it's going to be a fascinating read. So you can do that $60 contribution. You can do it at $5 a month. That can come off of a debit card or straight out of your checking account. However you would like to make a $60 contribution to KBOO, we would love to accept it and thank you with a copy of this book. 877-500-5266 or online at KBOO.FM. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, I'd just like to remind people, you know, that there's a lot of great writers out there, a lot of great activists, a lot of great community people that get a chance to amplify their voice on our airwaves, and we take that very seriously. And, you know, some of the programs I've done, Keep Nestle Out of the Gorge, Resistance Ecology, there is a war on the houseless going on in Portland. Interview with Seth Rosenfeld, author of Subversives, the FBI's War on Student Radicals and Reagan's Rise to Power. Rethinking Electroshock. I did Ralph Nader on his new book. Chris Hedges, and on and on and on. I've got pages here, and it goes back for years. But every talk show host can say the same thing. We bring you these voices, and we really take this very seriously. And so I hope you do, too. And we'll call us up. 877-500-5266.
Those are some excellent reasons to continue your support of community radio. Yeah, Paul has been a tireless voice for resistance here in Cascadia, and it's such a wonderful asset to the entire community so that we can keep hearing the guests that he brings on and the analysis he provides. 877-500-5266 is the number to call to connect with that and to say thank you to Paul and thank you to KBOO. Here is some financial support so that you can keep doing the things you do. We are listener supported. More than 80% of our funding comes directly from you, our listeners. And that is so important that you count yourself in that mix right now. 877-500-5266. Help us reach that $800 goal for talk radio this morning and help us reach the overall goal for our fall membership drive. We're well on our way. We got that $15,000 behind us for the fall Subvert sweepstakes. And that is super fantastic. Now we need to keep that momentum going with your call. 877-500-5266. Your $60 contribution will get you this thank you gift. That is a wonderful book, Daydream Sunset. You're listening to the interview right now. We'll go back to some more with Ron Jacobs and Paul Rowland, but let's give you that phone number and URL one more time. You can get us online, kboo.fm, or toll free, 877-500-5266.
And we're back. I'm Paul, and I'm with Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s. Well, it's really interesting, you know, that we're talking to you from Portland in Oregon to you in Vermont, because, you know, it's sort of, there's this sort of sister region sort of way of looking at things that, you know, a lot of people went to go back to the land in Vermont from the Northeast cities. A lot of radicals made their way to Vermont back in the, you know, late 60s, and same with Oregon, and they both have a, you know, are still some of the strongest centers of whatever remains of that counterculture that emerged so strongly in the 1960s, in which we're talking about today. And which you talk about in your book, Daydream Sunset. I just noticed today in Counterpunch, your fellow Vermonter, Brian Tokar, has a new article on Counterpunch 50 years ago this summer when Dylan went electric, which is exactly the kind of thing you talk a lot about in your columns, the kind of the soundtrack, the musical soundtrack to your experiences coming out of the 60s and into the 70s. I wonder if you talk about a couple of those threads. And again, this is a talk show. Obviously, we're kind of have a shortened version here because of the membership drive. But if you want to call in, if you're of that generation and want to ask Ron anything, the number is 503-231-8187 to call in. Yeah, so talk about Vermont, the importance of Vermont in this history.
Yeah, Vermont was. You ready?
Yep.
Yeah. Vermont was a because of its very rural character, which it still maintains pretty much to this day, and its closeness to Boston and the Boston and New York metropolitan areas, and also its closeness to Amherst. One can't forget that because Amherst was a hotbed of radicalism and counterculture. During its heyday because of the number of colleges there. So Vermont, when people started moving up to Vermont to go back to the land, as it were, it kind of started in 67, 68, 69. But 68 was a big year. Robert Hurrier, who was actually the founder of the Northeast Organic Farmers Association, he was a journalist on a big paper down in New Jersey out of Trenton. He went to the Democratic Convention in Chicago in 1968, saw the riots, and I quote him in my book when he's talking about 68 and what came after. And he goes, one could either join the Weathermen or they could move to Vermont. And he chose to move to Vermont, and he joined helped found a network of communes that they called Free Vermont, which was actually originally founded by some filmmakers and members of the Newsreel Collective, which was a left-wing news collective that would put together newsreels of all the different speeches, protests, and so on that had gone on the previous month, and then distribute them to student groups and to counterculture groups and to movie theaters in hippie ghettos all over the United States, where they would be shown just like the traditional newsreels were shown in movie theaters that were showing more conventional fare. They started a commune down in near Brattleboro, Vermont, and that they were one. There was like four or five different communes that started there. Burlington had several. Some were urban collectives, and some were rural collectives. And then there was quite a few over in the Green Mountains near where Goddard College, which at the time was an alternative. It was probably the first alternative college after Black Mountain shut down, and it was before Evergreen State College. I would say Reed was there too, of course. And Goddard was kind of more liberal, more alternative than Reed. And it was a breeding ground for communards and so on. So they started this whole network of food co-ops, babysitting co-ops, car garage co-ops. And they also started a newspaper that was distributed to everybody on all the different communes in Vermont, as well as distributed in the larger towns and cities in Vermont, which in Vermont they're still pretty small compared to most of the rest of the country. And they were very political in nature. This was 70-71. And large part of the reason they were so political was because so many of the people in Vermont who were of the counterculture were also old new lefties. And there was a lot of that influence that came into being. They invited the Black Panthers to come up and talk, which was a risky thing in Vermont at the time, because Vermont, even today, is still one of the whitest states in the country, kind of like Oregon and Washington are. But back then, the black people were a very rare sight. So when the Panthers came up, it kind of freaked people out. But, you know, that was part of the reason why they did it. So it played a key role in that. And also there's a Wavy Gravy and the Hog Farm. They started a thing called Earth People's Park way up in what we call the Northeast Kingdom in Vermont. And basically it was just an open piece of land that was owned by everybody and owned by nobody, where people could go and set up shop. And people would go up there and hang out during the summer, but it's very difficult if you don't know how to do it to survive without running water and some kind of heating system in a Vermont winter. So usually in the winter, those places were, that place was pretty empty.
And, you know, we haven't really talked about your own background. I mentioned that you were sort of on the cusp of the 60s and 70s, your coming of age. So what year did you graduate high school?
I graduated high school in 73.
And from where?
From Frankfurt, Germany. I had a different, an unusual trajectory. My dad was in the military. 1968, he went to Vietnam. I turned 13 in 68. And we went, when he came back from Vietnam, we moved over to Germany because he was stationed at a base over there in Frankfurt. And so I experienced a lot of the countercultural stuff in high school through German eyes. And while some of it was unique, a lot of it was basically American and British in origin anyhow. So in its own way, it was a kind of cultural imperialism, I guess you could, you know, the Marxian analysis might be. So I went to rock concerts and rock festivals overseas a lot during my high school years. And then when I came back to the States, I lived in New York City for, and went to college there for about a year before I moved back to, then I moved to Maryland and went to the University of Maryland, stayed there for a few years and moved out to the Bay Area in 1977. And part of the reason I moved to the Bay Area in 1977 was because I knew that the counterculture was still thriving in Berkeley, Santa Cruz, Santa Barbara, San Francisco, and in Northern California, plus up in the Northwest, it was still going strong. Whereas in the East Coast, it was quickly dying. It was just circumstances, capitalism, people getting older. The police repression had just really kind of knocked the wind out of its sails, so to speak, except in very, very in individual households and so on.
Well, you know, I'd like to explore that whole thing. I'm not sure how much time we'll have. You know, the way the whole counterculture was just so absolutely pervasive. You talk about that in your book, and you know, it's certainly been treated by other people as well. It's something that's really hard to think about. You know, like Occupy just sort of spread like wildfire, you know, in its brief heyday here. But it really didn't gain the sort of the extent and the depth that the counterculture, it didn't have really the time to develop like the counterculture in the 60s. Maybe we'll have a chance to explore that a little bit. We have a couple callers, and I'd also like to remind people that coming up on KBOO at 9, we've got Michelle Schroeder Fletcher speaking with Kentaro Toyama about his new book, Geek Heresy, Rescuing Social Change from the Cult of Technology. And at 9:30, Kate Harding will be talking about her book, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. And I'm speaking with Ron Jacobs, and we've got a caller on the line. LJ, go ahead. You're on. Ask Ron your question.
Yeah, hey, Paul. How you been?
Go ahead.
Jacobs. All right, listen, as an old hippie who spent a lot of time in my Ford Econoline with the big queen-size bed in the back and a great stereo system, going across country. I wonder if you can talk about the farm in Tennessee, and that whole farm experiment, from raising your own food to birthing your own children to educating your own kids. And I just wanted to remind my KBOO family that you'll only hear programming like this on KBOO. Sit down and cut a check. Have a good day.
All right. Thank you so much, LJ. The farm, Ron.
Yeah, absolutely. The farm was a very interesting experiment. It was basically apolitical, but it was more on the religious, spiritual side of the counterculture. Stephen Gaskin started it. He used to do these lectures in the Haight-Ashbury starting, I think, in 67, 68. And as the hate became uglier and uglier, you know, like the hard drugs came in, the police repression grew greater, he and a bunch of his followers, supporters, fellow believers, fixed up a bunch of school buses and drove down, bought some land outside of Summertown, Tennessee, in the middle of like a very redneck Bible Belt area. And of course, they were not happily received, but they proved now they're an institution there and around the world. They set up, they started a... They welcome women, teenagers, girls and women who are pregnant but don't want to get rid of their baby but don't feel like they can take care of it, don't want to go the traditional means. They can go there and they'll birth their baby. Ina Gaskin, Stephen's wife, has written some of the best books in the world on midwifery and childbirth and so on. And they and you can stay in touch with your child even if you like leave it after you have it because that's not where you're at in your life or whatever. They've got an incredible school system down there. They make a lot of good organic products and so on their farm. Nowadays, it's funny that I'm glad this person asked that. That nowadays, it's I've run into people. I work on college campuses a lot because I'm a librarian. So when I'm not working at a public library, I'm usually working in a college library. And in the last 10 years, I've run into easily a half dozen young men and women who were raised on the farm. Their mothers took advantage. I mean, decided to go with that option. They went down there. They had their baby, and they came and went and got to know their children. They're wonderful young adults, and they're perfect advertisements for doing something like that in every state in the United States and around the world.
All right, that's Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset, who you're listening to during our membership drive, first day of here on KBOO, and the number to call is 877-500-5266 to express your support for this kind of program. I'd like to just ask our next caller who's waiting in line to hold on a few minutes if you can, and we'll be back to renew this conversation.
After you renew your membership to KBOO, 877-500-5266. This is Ani. I'm here with Paul this morning, raising support and funds and members for Community Radio. Community Radio, KBOO. Well, we rely on your support. 83% of our annual budget comes directly from you, the individuals listening to this station. And right now we're asking you to step forward and do part of this lifting and help make KBOO stronger with your financial contributions. $10 a month or $15 a month is pretty doable for most of people listening right now. Just go ahead and add that into your monthly budget, you know, right up there with things that maybe aren't quite so community strengthening, like, you know, the other things that you do by subscription, you know, Netflix and Spotify and stuff. You know, those companies have you on an automatic payment plan, and we're asking you to actually make KBOO stronger with an automatic payment plan from you. You get to set the amount you can give every month, and just right now, make that call. 877-500-5266. With your contribution of $60 or more this morning, you can get a copy of this book as our way of thanking you for supporting your community radio station, KBOO. This book, of course, by Ron Jacobs. It's Daydream Sunset, the 60s counterculture in the 70s. You are listening to the interview with Paul. It sounds fascinating. There's so much that we can gather and glean from the social movements of the 60s and seeing how they wound through the 70s, looking at what's happening today. You can make the ties your very own self, but right now we're asking you to tie yourself to KBOO and become a sustaining member. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
And we're back. Thank you, Ani, and thank all of you who have called or are thinking of calling. We really appreciate your support. This is the way this station keeps going. It's a tried and true model pioneered by KPFA Pacifica way back in the 40s and continued by us and a number of other stations around the country. And we are talking with Ron Jacobs, as you heard, and we're going to go to our next caller in a second. You know, these points are really good. It's, you know, talking about the farm is an ongoing, you know, viable, real alternative to sort of individualistic, alienated life here, which, you know, a lot of the counterculture was really a reaction to and created a real serious alternative to. This isn't just an exercise in nostalgia, and I don't think your book is either. You know, we're talking about, you know, a very real alternative to the system, as it were, that became perceived very really as a threat to that system and was suppressed and recuperated and co-opted. But we'll carry on that thought. But let's go to our next caller. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul.
Morning.
Hi, it's Michael. And Ron, I was glad you brought up Wavy Gravy and you brought up the White Panther Party, because I think that's the grounding of the whole 60s movement. And of course, I'm a child of the 60s, graduated from high school in the Summer of Love, the whole thing. I was a drafty, conscientious objector, so I really got into it on the political end at first, and mainly the civil rights movement at first, and then through the politics, and then the White Panther Party. I grew up in Flint, Michigan. I'm friends with John Sinclair, and friends with Wavy, and I always see that they always try to define the counterculture as having Wavy on one end and Charles Manson on the other, etc. And the Manson part is why the whole thing collapsed. I really think that it got sidetracked at some point into the new ageism. It became way more me first, more individualistic. The great line in the great Cheech Marin movie where they're trying to rude awakening, where they're trying to rekindle the peace movement, and the one woman goes, "I've been working on myself so long it hurts to think about anybody else." and I think that is where it foundered, and I was wondering if you'd address that a little bit.
Absolutely. I tend to agree. I kind of like when I try to look at it through an economic perspective, or anyhow, when I look at it that way, I kind of see it as American capitalism's great moment that it understood how it needs to mutate and change, and so that it can continue to sell stuff and so on and so forth, create more units. I look at, there was always those two trends in the counterculture. There was the hip capitalists, and then there was the folks like the Yippies, the White Panther Party, and before them there was the Diggers down in San Francisco. And the Diggers were all about giving things away for free, about communal living, about everything for free. Then you saw, like, we'll go back to San Francisco, you saw the Family Dog, and you saw Bill Graham, two different kinds of concert promotion. Bill Graham loved making money. Family Dog was against making money. The Grateful Dead started with Family Dog, ended up with Bill Graham. They realized that was the only way they could survive. And I see that whole period that you're talking about, and that thing that happened, as being crucial to... They figured out how to sell religion. They turned it into the spirituality. They turned it into New Age. And I'm not saying they did it, like, intentionally. It's just kind of how capitalism works. And there's, of course, there was always a lot of people willing to sell their head shop, to sell their bong patent or whatever, sell their music to whoever was the highest bidder. And ultimately, that's kind of where it did turn into the stuff they couldn't sell, the revolution, the communal living, and so on, faded back into the background, or got thrown in jail, or ended up in even worse straits than either of any of that kind of stuff. The other stuff, people got involved in themselves, and then, I mean, capitalism likes that, because the more people are only paying attention to themselves, the more units of anything they can sell exist, they can create.
Well, you know, I just want to sort of flag the fact, note the fact that we are, in the way we're talking about, talking pretty much about the white counterculture. And of course, you know, in your book, you note that African-American culture and Native American culture influenced in various ways, some, you know, not so positively, some very positively, in the sense that, you know, some of it was sort of romanticized or taken out of context, but some of it was very real influence. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the African-American culture, obviously, so much of what we consider American culture now, we've gotten from the people who were brought over here as slaves and their descendants. That's true. That's true in music. That's true in writing. That's true in clothing styles and everything. And it was truly the case, I think, a lot with the counterculture, given that a lot of its roots were in the beats and the bebop jazz culture of the 50s, and rock and roll, which also came out of rhythm and blues and so on. And also there was the fascination, and this is the part that you're saying is like a romanticizing it, the fascination with African American people and African American culture. So it was, you know, in some ways it was fetishized, as they say, you know, and turned into something to sell back to people. Same with the Native American thing. I mean, we kind of see a rebirth of some of that aspect of the Native American thing with even less context than then, when the debates that occasionally appear after, like, say, Coachella or Burning Man, where people are criticized, white women are criticized for wearing Native American headdresses and stuff. And another place where you see it that still exists within the hippie counterculture is at rainbow gatherings. There's always that conflict. In fact, there was a big struggle going on this last summer where the Rainbow family wanted to hold their gathering in sacred lands up in the Black Hills. And several members and groups within the Ojibwa and Sioux nations were very much opposed to that because it's their sacred lands. And they said, how is this any different than, you know, building housing developments on burial grounds and so on? So, but they did influence it. I think people looked at the positive aspects of Native American and African American cultures and history, and did the best they could within the context of the time. I mean, I think there was always a lot of criticism, and I think at the time people were more willing to accept that criticism. That could just be my personal perspective than they are now. That's just, like I said, I mean, I can remember big struggles over you know, making sure that African Americans were represented, and then eventually women were represented on the same level as all us white guys were at political meetings and in planning committees for cultural events and stuff like that.
Well, those are important conversations to have between the older and the younger generations. I don't think we'll have time to pursue that here. It'd be something to think about for the future. But right now, I'd like to remind you that we are in our membership drive, and we really would like your support. We appreciate your support. We need your support. We depend upon your support. That's the way we keep going. And the number to call is 877-500-5266. And I'm also joined by Ani.
Good morning, Paul. Yes, in fact, and we've been joined with several other folks. It's a wonderful thing this morning. Your support is coming in, and we want to continue that support at 877-500-5266. Get us off to a very strong start this first day of our fall membership drive, like Linda in Clackamas, Lori in Portland, Gordon in Portland, and Eloise in Portland. Thank you all for renewing your memberships this morning, and we want to hear from you. Let's hear from four more members right now renewing your memberships or contributing for the very first time. Maybe you've been a KBOO member for a while, but you want to try out that monthly sustaining option. Please do. Give us a call, and you can start becoming a sustaining member of KBOO. No matter how you've given in the past, try it out. $10 a month or $15 a month. Go ahead and give it a whirl. 877-500-5266, that number to call. And we do, as Paul was saying, rely, depend, count on your support. It's edifying. It's it feels reciprocitous, right? As we are here bringing content that informs and inspires, that gives context and background, provides some history, digs deep into current events, and looks at how things started, where things came from. And that is really, I think, indicative of the interview that Paul is doing this morning with Ron Jacobs. 877-500-5266. Know our history, know our context. For your $60 contribution, we still have a couple copies left of Daydream Sunset, 60s Counterculture in the 70s. If you've been enjoying the interview, and I dare say you have because you're still listening, then go ahead, pick up the phone, contribute $60, and get a copy of this book as a thank you gift. 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm. What do you have to add, Paul?
Well, you know, I think that people who do listen to KBOO understand that this is something that is pretty much irreplaceable. You know, we don't like to think of ourselves as irreplaceable. But, you know, things that have been around since 1968, there just aren't that many counter institutions that have been around that long. And the reason we've been around that long is because we've had the continuous support of listeners like you. And I know there are some people who are listening, who are regular listeners, who just may not have gotten to that point yet of feeling the compelled, feeling that inner necessity of picking up that phone and going to the internet, kboo.fm, and expressing that support in a direct way. I think I just heard a call, so we do have one person. Let's get a couple more. We've got less than 10 minutes left in the show.
And about $500 left.
There you go. So give us a call at 877-500-5266.
Absolutely. 1968 was really a watershed year in so many ways, and so many brilliant institutions of the counterculture came together and really fomented came together and formed that year, like KABU Community Radio, the Oregon Country Fair, and the Metropolitan Learning Center, an alternative school in Northwest Portland that I went to high school in the 80s. But, you know, all of these things were coming out of this very creative, bubbling cauldron of people saying we can do things different. We can do things in a new way. We can come together with people power and actually create a new world. And that was a lot of that energy in the late 60s. This book, Sunset Daydream, you can see that energy and where it goes in the 70s. And you can be a part of this resurgence of resistance right now. Pick up the phone and dial 877-500-5266. 877-500-5266. Or online, kboo.fm. It just takes a moment of your time. And right now, we'd love to hear. We have three lines open, so let's fill them up with your call of support, getting our fall membership drive off to a fantastic start. 877-500-5266.
Thank you so much, Ani, and thank all of you who have called in and are about to call in or will call in your support to that number, 877-500-5266. And once again, I am speaking with Ron Jacobs, author of Daydream Sunset. And gosh, there's just so much to talk about, but people should pick up a copy of your book. You know, one thing I've thought a lot about is, since I kind of missed the whole punk movement when it started, even though I was really kind of that age, I kind of missed really, I was just 3 years younger than you, Ron. When I got to high school, it was pretty much all over. I mean, I was kind of a wallflower, you know, at the time, and not all that social. But, you know, I would have noticed if there was a lot of ferment going on in the hallways, out on the park in front of the high school. But it just really had kind of ended. It just, like, very suddenly. But then, you know, just a few years after that, the punkers, talk a little bit about that in the last few minutes. The sort of the tension between, you know, the new rebellious generation of the punks and the older hippie generation.
I was living in Berkeley, California at the time, and the punk thing, that was one of its birthplaces, the Bay Area, you know, the Dead Kennedys and so on. We would see bands all the time coming down from Vancouver. We would get a lot of L.A. bands and so on in little clubs. I always thought a lot of that tension was contrived by the media and trying to turn the hippies against the punks and so on, kind of like it was like in the 60s, the Beatles fans against the Rolling Stones fans. But at the same time, some of it was genuine, I would say, at the beginning, mostly because for hippies, people who were used to a more blues-based, melodic kind of music, punk was kind of difficult to listen to because it's harsh and so on. And there was always an edge of violence that, either real or imagined, definitely seemed to exist at a lot of punk shows that didn't exist at most, like free hippie counterculture, you know, rock shows and rock festivals and so on. I think as time went on, but at least in the Bay Area, by the early 80s, there was an understanding that punks, and especially the remaining freaks, the ones living on the streets, the ones coming living over in the Haight or on hanging out on Telegraph Avenue and stuff, there was an understanding that they had a common enemy, which was, like, you know, the police and the main mainstream culture and so on. And they also shared similar politics in terms of anarchy and anti-racism and so on. Over in Britain, I talked about this a little bit, which is where punk was, where another place where punk was strong. the rock establishment there was much more of an establishment. I mean, you had the Rolling Stones who were hanging out with, you know, hanging out with royalty and rich people, super rich people, and so on, intentionally. And then you had also David Bowie doing his rich guy thing and stuff like that. And them, Eric Clapton, making statements saying he supported Emmett Powell's anti-immigrant platform and so on. So there, as in a lot of things over in Europe, punk immediately took a political turn, and they began the Rock Against Racism movement, which was huge over in England. And basically, in the United States, it was sponsored by some punk groups and the Yippies, and it existed, but it was nowhere to the extent that that it was over in England. Partly at the same time, punk was never really big, and I think part of that was because punk intentionally tried to stay away from the main distribution labels, so they tried to distribute their own stuff. And when you do that, while you can remain pure to your ideology or whatever, it's a lot harder to get your records out there. It's a little easier now with indie and so on, but even now, indie labels often get picked up.
Okay, Ron, we gotta run. I'm sorry to cut this short. You know, this has been really fascinating. There's so many different threads to go that we could go in, and it's the 50th anniversary year of so much stuff this year, and it will continue to be. People continue to reflect on this. I urge people to pick up your book, Daydream Sunset, the 60s Counterculture in the 70s, and to call us up, 877-500-5266. Thank you so much, Ron Jacobs.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to everybody who listened, and hi to my friends in Portland. Talk to you later.
All right.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Elephant Revival is a five-piece band from Colorado that play folk music with Gypsy, Celtic, and Americana influences. The show is originally scheduled for Revolution Hall, and all tickets for that show will be honored. Again, that's Elephant Revival, Thursday, September 10th, 10:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Let the fires burn tonight. Let the jugs of wine get drunk.
KBOO would like to thank the restaurants that donated food for our volunteers today. Kenny and Zooks for providing breakfast. They have three locations in Portland serving pastrami, bagels, sandwiches, and other deli items. Located at 1038 Southwest Stark, 3901 North Williams, and 2370